Thank you. And for the record, I have given Dr. Rust the 2007 New England Journal of Medicine article that's in front of him, and that was filed as Petitioner's Exhibit 48. And Doctor, the question I asked you before the break was, Dr. Corbier relied on this article to support his hypothesis that thimerosal-containing vaccines can cause neurodevelopmental problems. Do you agree with that that's the conclusion of that article?
No, I don't.
What does that article stand for?
Well, I'd looked at this article just after it came out, and I just wanted to make sure that I hadn't overlooked anything in it. The point of this study was to try to find if there is any association between early thimerosal exposure and neuropsychological outcomes, and it's important to do such detailed studies. And in fact, the result of the study is absolutely contrary to the idea that there's some association. It shows no association between those two things. I believe reference was made to the occurrence of tics. This is interesting, but not pertinent. Phonic and motor tics are fairly common in children. It's another problem that one could wonder why we're seeing so much more of than we were in the past, and there's no doubt that, in fact, it's just because things are being brought to our attention that weren't being brought there before. Enormous numbers of children have tics. This is a small study, and probably there's a selection bias or something of that sort that caused this particular problem to rise to the surface as something that had the suggestion of again, what we do is confidence intervals, trying to see not only that we find something and it's more common in one group than the other, but that it's significantly more common, and this rose to a level that it requires further study. Tics are not a feature of autism. Typically, there are patients with autism that have tics. About 8 to 11% of boys have tics at some point in their lives, a slightly smaller number of girls, at least so we think. We think that perhaps they're overlooked in girls because what brings the boys to our attention is the hyperactive component of attention deficit hyperactivity disease or disorder. It's not even either one of those things. It's a part of a normal human function that can cause problems. And the girls tend not to have that, so they don't come to our attention. They may have attention problems. They may have tics, but we don't get the chance to see them. So what this shows is that maybe there's something there in terms of an association. But further study is required, and it's not in any way pertinent to the consideration of autism. The important message of this paper is in one well-performed study, it was demonstrated that there isn't any association between thimerosal early exposure and things related to neuropsychological abnormalities or autism.
And Dr. Corbier was talking about tics in his testimony yesterday. What is a tic?
Well, there are two kinds of tics. There's a motor tic and there's a phonic tic. Motor tics come somebody who actually has tics and is frequently associated OCD features, wrote a large book and a set of studies on this thing and divides motor tics into 56 different types and phonic tics into 47 or 48 different types. It's a common thing amongst people. It's sort of catching in that if somebody has a tic, some other people pick it up. It's seen if it persists for more than 1 year with both motor and phonic tics, then we make the diagnosis of Tourette syndrome, which is generally a benign condition that's also a developmental thing. As with other developmental processes involving the intellect and the emotions and behavior of people, it has its positive sides and its negative sides, it's something we're called on to address because of that.
And you just stated that if tics go on for more than a year, then you label them Tourette syndrome. What is the usual course of tics?
Usually they go away within a year, and so the enormous number of children that have tics, people that have sat in classrooms observing children find a huge number that have tics. This is a report by neuropsychologists that, as you can see, reported more tics in the girls than their parents did. Again, we see that kind of bias in observation. These are exceedingly common things. You can see them in bus stations and with baseball players when they get up to bat. Nomar Garciaparra has the most remarkable stereotypic tics, which are quite repetitive. They seem to have a function for people in terms of allaying different kinds of feelings that people might have and become more common when people are anxious during test-taking situations.
I just want to wrap up with just a couple of questions on Dr. Corbier's testimony and on his report. And I want to refer you, I don't know if you have it in front of you, it's a petitioner's Exhibit 26, which is Dr. Corbier's report. And on page 7 of that report, he discusses the conventional view of autism. Could we hand you a copy, or do you have it with you?
Yes, I believe it's
page 7.
What would you like me to comment on?
Does Dr. Corbier accurately describe the conventional view of autism? And is there a term called conventional view of autism?
Well, I believe I commented on this section in my own report. One person's view of what's conventional and another's may not be the same. And this arises all the time in medicine. So what we tend to do is to hold large conferences and arrive at criteria for things. And so criteria are a little bit different than conventional views. Conventional views could be an inaccurate reflection of people if they've not been assembled in one place. And in fact, that's not happened. We haven't assembled the neurological community all into one place to come up with diagnostic criteria. But we have assembled experts on the field, and there are features that people regard as being important elements of diagnosis. The view that's expressed here did not strike me as what I would call conventional, however. And I think that the views of this section are not those of most people that with whom I work on autism.
Doctor, he follows up with the parental hypotheses, which is also on page 7.
Yes, uh-huh. Well, I'm sorry.
And Dr. Russ, have you read the parental hypotheses?
Yes, I read that section as well. I can't comment on it specifically because I haven't spoken to the parents about the hypothesis, and I would just have to presume that this is an accurate reflection of the parental point of view about what's going on. It's similar to points of view that parents of children that I care for with autism have, and it's the privilege of a parent to have their view about things. There are many aspects of this that, as you can understand from what I've said earlier, I disagree with. I think it's important that these things surface in meeting with parents of children with autism so that we at least understand that we're listening to each other.
Dr. Corbier's opinion also rests on that there are multiple environmental factors, some of which cannot be identified, that all contribute to the development of autism. Could you comment on whether that is a hypothesis accepted in the medical community?
The emerging view of autism, as I've described, is the working out of a genetic development of brain that doesn't develop properly, and the degree of that abnormality helps to differentiate the time of onset of subtypes of autistic disorders, and may be related to conditions that are now in the autistic spectrum that might belong elsewhere. So we know the most about the classic autism and the regressive autism. That's our largest number of patients. Remind me what your question was, Lyle.
About whether there's other environmental factors along with vaccines that all contribute.
I think that would represent too difficult a point of view to perform careful research on. We need to start with the most promising areas in which we can then make an observation and then try to sort out as time goes on what other things may contribute to it. It's quite clear that the genetic view of autism is going to represent the overwhelmingly most important aspect of autism. It's also quite clear that children can have features that to various degrees resemble autism from other kinds of environmental insults, but those conditions need to be set apart for the very important reason that that first of all families might not because of the question of guilt over genetically inherited disease, because of the question of what the risk for other children in the family is, future children, these need to be carefully addressed by us, and so we need to set those apart from environmental stimuli that may do things. In parents that have had a child that had something that's related to an extrinsic non-genetic insult, we can provide counseling that is a little different in terms of whether the family would like to have another child and so forth. So we need to make these distinctions very carefully. If you multiply determinants, the statistical evaluation, which is the way in which we see whether things the way in which we see that things repeat themselves, that are validated in studies, become very difficult to perform. Oftentimes, people will multiply two, three, four, five different things, and say, you know, which one has something to do with things. And oftentimes, those studies are done without the kind of corrections that are necessary for what we call multivariate analysis. It's very difficult to do multivariate analysis if you don't first know the frequency of some particular problem in the environment. So that's the first step towards doing these multivariate analyses. Once you get some information suggesting repeatable observations, that's the point at which they need to be parsed out, the individual part of it, and then reconsidered. If we consider a combination of things, the typical outcome of that, and there have been such studies in medicine, is to generate data that's not of any value.
Doctor, you have reviewed the video of V8 Hazelhurst, correct?
Yes, I have.
And in some of the videos, Yates has a little bit of a distended belly. Would you agree?
Yes. There was one particular, he was running in a diaper in something that looked like Scandinavia or something. I don't know where.
In your opinion, did Yates look like a child who was suffering from malabsorption?
No, as I mentioned, his growth and development includes weight at the 95th percentile or above in a steady way. The belly was a little bit big, it must be said. In a child that has a recent change of diet, or in a child that has stool retention, or in a child that's eaten a great deal of particular foods, that kind of distension typically is either gaseousness or contents. The child with kwashiorkor, we think about those children as having distended bellies, appear absolutely differently from what we saw in that picture there.
Doctor, have you ever testified in Vaccine Act cases?
Twice.
And did you testify on behalf of respondent or petitioner in those cases?
In both those cases, it was on behalf of a child and family.
And why have you agreed to testify and serve as an expert for respondent today?
Well, I was asked and thought it was important.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
I would like to go ahead and take about a half hour break.
How long are you planning?
I'm not sure I need it all, but I don't need to put my notes together. So the cross examination, I do not anticipate being very long. I'm going to be here back at 12:30 or 11:30, I mean.
That's quite an extended
time. Yeah, 11:30.
How about we go for, it's about 7 after. We'll give you 20 minutes to collect your thoughts.
Okay.
And let's be back here by 11:25 and go forward.
Okay.
We're in recess until 11:25.
Maybe we can get the conference room listed.